Good evening and welcome to Atlantic Tales on Clare FM. On today's show, we visit the Cliffs of Moher, Ireland's most popular natural tourist attraction, and the nearby Moher Hill Open Farm. The Cliffs of Moher in County Clare tower 702 feet above the Atlantic Ocean and are Ireland's most visited natural tourist attraction. Aside from the spectacular vista, the area surrounding the Cliffs of Moher is well documented in its fascinating history. From the world-famous O'Brien's Tower, you can see many other historic landmarks from Kerry to Galway, while locally the area is steeped in legend, folklore and mythology. Kira Carew is a customer service agent and tour guide at the Cliffs of Moher and joined the team in 2019.
Well, the educational opportunities are everlasting here. I find since I started here, I've learned so many stories, and you would learn it from word of mouth. So just listening to whether it's local stories who come up here or ranger stories, etc., you pick it up as time goes on. And what I find is you learn your own way of telling it as well. You have your own lingual. There's a few stories now I'd be fascinated with, such as how Hag's Head got its name. It's a story about Cú Chulainn and the hag called Mal. And this old hag called Mal fell in love with Cú Chulainn, and Cú Chulainn didn't return his feelings to Mal, and this made her outrageously crazy. So she decided to chase Cú Chulainn, and the chase went wildly all along the edge of the cliff, over mountains, through the burn, across the land of County Clare, until they reached Loop Head. And at Loop Head, Mal was convinced she had Cú Chulainn cornered there near the edge of the cliff. But Cú Chulainn, being a remarkably strong warrior, managed to leap from sea stack to sea stack all the way back to the Cliffs of Moher. And Mal sure tried to follow him once again, but her, not being as nimble on her footing, slipped on a sea stack and dashed against the side of the cliff to a gruesome death. And they say her blood flowed throughout the Atlantic Ocean as far as the town as Milltown, which henceforth became known as Milltown Malbay. And they also say the cliffs took on the formation of her face. So down below to the south, you'll see a big lump coming out on the cliff, and it kind of looks like the face of a woman. So we call that Hag's Head.
How do people react to stories like that?
From all generations, it doesn't matter. It's a mixture of generations, and you see a certain excitement on their faces. You know, a lot of people have heard of the likes of Cú Chulainn and all, and it's when you bring that Irish twist to it, there's a familiarisation there. And I would nearly call it a pride that this is part of our culture and our heritage. And you always kind of see that they're picking up the story, and they might bring it on or carry it on and tell someone else.
Kira has a particular interest in the history of O'Brien's Tower, which was built in 1835 by local landlord Cornelius O'Brien.
We'd consider him the grandfather of tourism here at the Cliffs. He lived just down the road to the south in a mansion called Birchfield House. So throughout his life, he had great vision for tourism here at the Cliffs. So he decided to build O'Brien's Tower along with a few other elements that you'll see along the cliffs. And a lot of people think O'Brien's Tower might have been for military purposes or a lighthouse, but it was technically termed a folly. And a folly was a place for entertainment. So Cornelius O'Brien, also being a member of Parliament, he'd bring special guests up there for singing and dancing and wining and dining. So you'd call him an entertainer at the time. And of course, you can still go up to O'Brien's Tower today. You get beautiful enhanced views of the cliffs. Now, back during this time when Cornelius O'Brien was doing his building projects, this was around the time of the Great Irish Famine, and landlords would have been the only people with the economic and political influence to help the distress of the poor during the famine. Now, many landlords didn't rise to the task, but Cornelius O'Brien was one of the great exceptions. He managed to secure government funding to enhance the educational opportunities of his people. He also secured funding to improve local infrastructure, which helped connect this area with surrounding townlands. He provided financial assistance to tenants to improve their farms, and he secured employment for locals here in this area. He owned 10,000 acres of land, which is a huge amount of land for someone to own back then. So he had amazing influence in this area back then. And I suppose the rest, like Ireland, was going through a state of misery during the famine with emigration, poverty, starvation. But you could see the start of this place flourishing, and that was basically tourism coming into the area and the economic advantage that was coming from his influence.
What about Cornelius O'Brien himself? Do we know much about the character? Obviously a very wealthy man, that he could build a beautiful tower on arguably the most scenic part
of County Clare and possibly the West Coast as well. Do we know much about him?
We know that he's actually buried down at St Bridget's Well, in a vault just behind St Bridget's Well, and St Bridget's Well is located very near the ruins of Birchfield House. Now, he was also responsible for building the rustic seating and the well house at St Bridget's Well. And the reason for that was he fell ill at one stage in his life. He had a problem, an eye condition, and he ordered for holy water to be sent to him. And the water miraculously cured his eyes, apparently. And ever since, locals believe that there is miraculous healing powers in that water. So we see pilgrims coming every year on St Bridget's Day and Garland Sunday, keeping up that tradition of visiting the well and, I suppose, believing in the magic of it. I think that says something about Cornelius O'Brien. He cared about the people and their beliefs. There was a caring nature to him. Now, he was a member of Parliament and he had that high status influence, but you can tell there was something very human about him in that he did care about his tenants and the people's beliefs. You know, he'd always host visitors who would come from particularly England at the time. He was a great host, so I think that does say something about his character. An entertainer, if you think of it, yeah.
Well, how do people react when they see the tower and find out that it's not related to any military history in Ireland, that it actually was, as you call it, a folly, a place for entertaining guests? How do they react to that?
I suppose there's always a great surprise as well. You know, I think their mindset, they kind of imagine when they're walking through the door, oh, I wonder what it was like back then, what they were wearing, the music in the background. I think it really does help them see the atmosphere that was up there back then. Now, when they do mention military, like, was it for military purposes? Of course it wasn't, but there was a tower down the south of the cliffs. It was a signal tower built in the early 1800s by the British, and it's a Napoleonic signal tower. So it was built during the Napoleonic Wars. So obviously it was for military purposes. So at the time, they were keeping a lookout for the French on the horizon in case ships came. Now, mm-hmm. The French never actually arrived because Napoleon was defeated in Waterloo. But, of course, the signal tower is still standing there today, and they had a number of signal towers along the coast to contact each other if there was a threat. So we have that military part of things if people are interested.
But O'Brien's Tower itself was basically for entertaining. Would the Cliffs of Moher be as popular if not for Cornelius O'Brien?
You know, I'd say they wouldn't have been, because even if you look back at material, there's travel journals from the early 1900s, and I've read several little snippets of travel journals, and you have people coming from England, Germany, travelling through Ireland and writing little snippets about the Cliffs of Moher and the legacy of Cornelius O'Brien. So he really did leave a massive legacy behind him. And I think, like, you know, no matter what, if someone is to talk about the heritage of the cliffs, Cornelius O'Brien is always mentioned. The tower went through a bit of evolution as well. There was records in, I think it was little newspaper snippets we had, of stable boys actually sleeping up in the tower, and cattle and sheep coming into the tower as well. So it did kind of, it had its peaks and troughs in terms of tourism. Now in 2019, we restored the tower up there above. There's a lime render coating on it to keep out dampness. So it does have that new look again. But all the original part of the tower is all in the inside, you know. So it's still standing there today. And I think when you say to people it was built in 1835, and the fact that it's still standing there, and it looks like it's going to be standing there for a long, long time to come, and it's well cared for as well, I think they really kind of, you know, they're impressed with that, and they appreciate the value that we show to something like this.
At the Cliffs of Moher, there is so much more to see than the 8 kilometres of sheer rock face shaped by time. The cliffs are home to tens of thousands of birds, marine life, as well as sea and land mammals. And you could see anything in the car park or even the gift shop, as customer service agent Mike Marin told me.
If you come up here early in the morning and the mist is lifting in the car park over here, you might actually see a hare going through and a fox with a bit of a discarded sandwich from yesterday's sort of guests. And then you'll walk up and you'll see all manner of little birds. We've got pipits here. We've got all manner of swallows nesting in the actual building. It's become a haven for wildlife itself. There was a guy in the shop the other day who put his hand up to reach a mug, and a lizard ran down. A common lizard ran up his shoulder, and it was like, whoa, what's that all about? You know, and it's like, you know, it's everywhere. And you come up here, if you've got a pair of binoculars especially, but you can, with your naked eye, you can see puffins, guillemots, razorbills, ravens, peregrine falcons, kittiwakes, fulmars, everything. All life is here. And especially at the moment, where they've just sort of bred, so everything is sort of on the go. Everybody's overfeeding at the moment, and you can hear them chattering below us. And they're just literally going on their way now to try and fledge the nest. So you've got nearly 60,000 birds all overfeeding, trying to get. There's a real frenetic sort of energy around here. And you can look at that with a pair of binoculars that you can get one in the visitor centre if you haven't got one. We'll give you a loan of them. Come up here and have a look down. It's just all life is happening down here.
Are these birds visitors, or are some of these birds regulars? Are they here all the time?
Well, the peregrine falcon stay here year round. The choughs are residents, and the big ravens are residents as well. And they're sort of, you know, they're opportunistic killers, really. The peregrine, of course, we know will take a bird. It'll come down about 200 kilometers an hour and break a bird's back using its own neck. And it'll take a puffin, full puffin, and take it over to a rock over here. And we know where it goes and where it has its butcher's block over here. And we can see them tearing apart puffins. And sort of, we show that to people and they kind of go, oh my God, I'm seeing a puffin, but his legs are flying off and there's blood everywhere. And then we have visitors. I mean, the auks, the puffins, razorbills and guillemots, they come on land for 3 months every year. And this is it. They breed, they fledge, they go. And the rest of the 9 months, they live out in the ocean. Great big rafts of birds. They may hit land when it's really bad weather over sort of towards Canada or the up above sort of Iceland or even down the Bay of Biscay. But they really don't like coming on land unless they have to. They'll just bob along in sort of really nutrient-rich waters and take the sand eels. That's all they're interested in, little fish. And there's about 5,000 or 6,000 of those. 5,000 or 6,000 puffins. Mm-hmm. There's probably 20,000-30,000 guillemots here at the moment. And some razorbills, yeah. We have them in their thousands. I think the star of the show, really, is the guillemot. Because of the geology we have here, if you look at the strata of the cliffs, you have hard rock, and you have shale, and you have shingle. And it gives, the erosion gives you perfect little sort of 6-inch ledges where the guillemots come. They come in sort of May time. They get up there, they mate, they have an egg. 21 days after that, the egg hatches. And that egg is spectacular. It's evolved to this sort of ovoid pyramidal shape. So it's like the normal bottom of a round egg, but with a cone on top. So it points. So the wind doesn't catch it. And when it rolls, it just rolls into itself. So it won't roll off the ledge. I mean, it's just, it's evolved fantastically. And also the guano, the poo, sticks that to the rock, giving it further stability. And those guys, they nest or perch way far up, so 600-700 feet up the cliff. And at this time, they're feeding now. They're about to fledge. So they're really, really feeding. Everything is, as I say, this frenetic feed, 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 fatten up. Because the chicks actually don't fledge. They don't fly when they leave. They're actually called jumplings. So they get really fat. They have very out, sort of strong feathers on the outside. And they literally put one foot over, keel over, and hit rocks on the way down. And they kind of go boop, 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 boop. And end up in the water, and you think, oh my God, it's dead. And then the father, who's been waiting patiently, will go over, pick it up, shake it, and off they go. And that's it. They're off out in the ocean for the next 9 months.
Incredible stuff.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. But that's just one of the species. Yeah.
What's your favourite part of the job? What's your favourite species of bird, first of all?
I think the fulmar. We can see one here, actually.
It's like a seagull, it's small.
Yeah, exactly. They're like a seagull, but they just have their wings flat out. They're, you know, but they have this desalination plant on their beak, and they can skip along the salt water, and they take in the salt water and they get rid of the salt through their nostrils on their beak. But if a predator comes anywhere near them, they take a bit of food that they've semi-digested out of their gizzard, they mix it with the salty snot and spit it at the wing of the predator. So they are the fantastic, you know, they'll take anything. Don't go anywhere near a fulmar. They're brilliant.
While Mike enjoys working and dealing with people, he hasn't always worked at the Cliffs of Moher.
I actually spent most of my life in hotels and sort of hospitality. I then sort of took time out and did a degree in ecology. And coming here seemed to have that perfect marriage of both sort of being with people and also with wildlife, which is my main love, really. When you're sort of mid-30s, you think you're going to save the planet, so I just decided I wanted to save the planet. I always kind of liked looking at birds, and I liked looking at grass, and I liked looking at the sea, and I never sort of thought I'd be any way proficient at it. I haven't got a great sort of memory for sort of memorizing what species this is or the other is, but and just by observing stuff, you kind of pick things up. It's funny.
What exactly are you doing here then at the Cliffs?
Well, fortunately, over the last two lockdowns, the guys here have allowed us to do a little bit of monitoring of species, of plants and birds. So we might be given an hour a day to head off with a pair of binoculars and look, and we might bring a couple of other people who are working here up and sort of share a bit of knowledge. And that works really well. If you're doing a tour with somebody and a puffin flies out of somewhere, you can just kind of go, oh, look, there's a puffin, or oh, look, there's a fulmar, or look, there's a guillemot, and whatever. And people will say, how do you know that? And it's just like, it's literally hours. You put the hours in, you don't really have to try and do it. It just kind of sinks in automatically almost. It just kind of comes in via osmosis almost into your brain. So we have a number of species of birds up here, which are just some of the most breathtaking and fantastic, and some of them are really interesting, and some of them are kind of just there and living around and, you know, minding their own business.
Coming up after the break, we'll find out more about the world-famous Cliffs of Moher and what can be seen there.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit oloughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to the programme. The Cliffs of Moher tower 214 metres or 702 feet above the Atlantic Ocean and are Ireland's most visited natural tourist attraction. Prior to the pandemic taking hold, staff at the Cliffs were gearing up to welcome a record number of visitors, having seen over 1.6 million people visit in 2019. Bridget Ford is another customer service agent and tour guide with a particular interest in the flora and fauna of the area. And some visitors come to the Cliffs of Moher as much for the flora and fauna as the incredible views.
So I started getting an interest during COVID when I was here. I was watching the seasons develop around Burren National Park, and I got an interest in it then, and I thought, I was doing a course reading the landscape, and that gave me the opportunity to do a project. So I thought I would do the folklore of the flowers and their healing values that they had back in the day. They still have, you know. Like the yarrow here, this is an example. The farmers used to wear this around their necks when they were going to the march or the fairs, and it would bring them good luck. So they all have a story. Like, we got honeysuckle, we got some grass, some plantain, we got some dandelions, and we got some sea pink. They're fading away at the moment. The reason they grow here on the cliff edge, because they can tolerate the salt here at the cliff edge. So yeah, and we do have orchids. We're letting our land go a bit wild because we're trying to get seed off it this year. We have the perfect opportunity. Down near the visitor centre, we have a wildflower meadow, and then up along here we have bird's foot trefoil because it's a different type of soil and it's facing the south, so it gets more sun. Then at the back of the visitor centre, it's a bit of a wetland there, so we have rushes around there. Yeah, it's all to do with the type of climate, what type of soil. We have four different orchids here, which is very unusual, you know, because it's quite windy, salty.
And it's not just about the cliffs and the birds, it is about the flora and the fauna as well. There's so much here. Do you find that people are coming particularly for that?
Yes, they are, yeah, definitely. They come along. We do ranger patrol here, and they come up to the cliff edge and they'll be asking you about this flower and, you know, all the flowers, and they live together and all the type of grasses. We've got over 100 different species of plants here. So, and we have been doing some observation lately. With COVID, we have less numbers, but nature is also flourishing. Between the first lockdown and this second lockdown, we've observed that we have, like, in an area, we observed we had 9 plants in this area last year. We had 19 this year due to, you know, because things are allowed to go wild, and we're not managing it. We're not strimming it, or we're not cutting it down. We let it go to seed.
This is pure natural. People don't expect to see freshly cut lawns up here. This is pure natural land.
Yeah, yeah, we got everything. Everything is good here. You know, although you've got dandelions, it's good for the bees. You've got thistles, good for the bees and the butterflies. You know, it's all playing its part, you know.
Meeting people, obviously, Bridget, a big part of your job.
Oh, yes, I love to talk.
What's the one particular part of this job that brings you in every day? What's your favourite part of the job?
Meeting the people. As a tour guide, you know, you're always giving them information and just seeing the little kids, especially during the COVID now, we have more families here, seeing them running around and they're really enjoying it. And all the, like Tom down there now, you can see him, he's down there with the birds and he's feeding the birds and the children come up and they're so happy, little girls to go up to the tower because they're little princesses going up the tower. That kind of thing, you know, families around the place is beautiful.
The Cliffs of Moher, of course, as well, Bridget, is part of the Cliffs of Moher Burn UNESCO Geopark, a very important status to have, and there's so much conservation going on here.
Yes, all the time. This is why part of the reason we're letting the grass grow wild and the conservation, and we're doing the recycling, trying to get as much recycling done here as possible. Leave no trace is another thing. We're trying to, you know, have no litter around the place. All you'll be taking with you is just your memories. So, yeah, we're... you know, trying to improve our conservation here.
People coming here from all over the world as well, meeting not just Irish people or English-speaking people, you're meeting people from all over.
Oh, all different nationalities, and they're just so fascinated by the cliffs, and you tell them the stories and the Harry Potter cave down there, and the children, they just light up their faces, and then you tell them how the cliffs were formed, which the river delta, the sandstone, silt and mud, and it was all put together. And then the fossils, as you can see on the steps, it's all part of the formation of the cliffs, you know.
One of the longest serving members of staff at the Cliffs of Moher is Ranger Tom Doherty. Tom previously worked as a stonemason and has a great knowledge of the famous Liscannor stone, which also makes up much of the paving and walls around the Cliffs of Moher Visitor Centre. There is one particular part of the job which Tom really enjoys.
Meeting people and talking to them about the cliffs, and they're always looking for that photograph, that iconic photograph. No matter where you go in the world, you'll always see photographs of the cliffs. One time I was in Canada, in Vancouver, went into a hotel there at a bar, and on the menu, photographs of the cliffs and the round tower down in Doolin, Dungord Castle. And I was just taken back by what I saw.
So many thousands of kilometres away.
Kilometres away, yeah.
And the Cliffs of Moher still there.
Still following me around. Yeah.
And the attraction, what you can see here on a good day or a bad day, it's still something you can appreciate.
Yes, and a day like today with the place covered in fog and you can't see it. As the saying goes, you can't see your hand. But I explained to them, like, you know, if you stop and listen to the sounds of the birds clattering away for spaces on the ledges and the cliffs, to the sea, as John O'Donoghue said, have an ancient conversation with the rocks below us, which is a lovely quote. And just to listen to those sounds, and then there's days when it's just hammering against the base of the cliff. It's a different sound again.
And so much history associated with the cliffs as well, and so many movies made here. Of the stories and of the history, what particularly stands out for you?
I love telling the story of Mara Rua when Cromwell came and he took over all the land, and the good land he took, and the castles. He took over Limerick Castle, and Mara Rua was the daughter of the owner of the castle. She said, I'm going to get this land back for the family. So he had put a soldier in charge of the land and the castle. So she said, by hook or by crook, I'm getting the land back for the family. So she married the soldier. She also had a horse trained to come here to the cliffs and to come right to the edge and stop suddenly and put down his head, and the guy went straight out over his head and in, over the cliffs, and the horse went back to Limerna. So that happened a couple of times, like another soldier step up and take over the position again. So it happened 4 or 5 times, but the last time, as the horse came here, the hill, as you go back down to Doolin, is called Ailvish the Cree, the hill that broke the horse's heart. As the horse came up, he collapsed and died. So the soldier walked back to the Limerna, and when Mara saw him, she says, where's my horse? And he said, the horse died. And she accused him of riding the horse so hard that he killed him. So she just gave him one kick into the stomach that killed him. So she eventually got the lands back and the castle. And that's where the story of Ailvish the Cree came from.
An amazing story. So if you crossed Mara Rua and she sent you off for riding the horse, you weren't coming back.
you're not coming back. And if you do...
you'll get a kick. When you're meeting people and talking to people and telling them these stories, it must be great to see the look on their faces. Many might be going, I'll go out of that. But there are so many, many people who love that kind of stuff.
Yeah, some people will ask, have you got any stories about the cliffs? And like I tell them, because here in Ireland, people, before televisions were and radios were invented, people went from house to house telling stories. And that's where all these stories began, like, you know, in people's kitchens. And like there was a famous Stephen Hillary who lived just a few miles back in Doolin. And he told stories, like, and they went on for maybe two or three nights. The one story, like, you know, they were told in Gaelic. And somebody was telling me lately that they've been translated into English.
Not only does Tom enjoy meeting people, but he has a little fun with his visitors too.
Especially the Americans, they say, how far can you see? I say, you can see as far as the Statue of Liberty. And if you look, it's very clear, you will see her with the hand up. Before I began to tell the story, I had to go back and educate myself about where that statue came from, and then what hand she had up, which is the right hand, and I usually put up my left hand when I'm talking to them. And I ask, which hand has she up? And they'll be thinking, and then they'll say the left hand. I say, no. And what has she on her left hand? She's got a book, and she's got the torch in the right hand.
How do the Americans react to that?
They feel embarrassed. But I get a great enjoyment out of it.
But what can you really see from the Cliffs of Moher, Tom?
Well, actually, you can see a loop head and way down in the Kerry Mountains. And then back north, then you're looking at the Arran Islands and Connemara, which are great views also.
And do you find people are coming back here after being here, we'll say, 30 years ago or 40 years ago? And they see the changes, of course, as well.
Yeah, some people, like, I've come in and said, like, you know, where is the guy that was here with the donkey and the dog on his back and the pipe in the dog's mouth? That's gone back maybe 25, 30 years ago. They were only kids, like, when they were passing with their parents, yeah. And they came in, and then they're older now and they'll think of that and they'll say, I must go in and have a look at the cliffs again, and they'll ask about the guy with the dog, the donkey and the dog.
When you're here as long as you are you sort of an unofficial weatherman as well? You must be able to read the weather pretty well at this stage.
You learn how to do the weather, like, you know, from different seasons. And like this year now, it hasn't been a great summer so far. And according to what I've learned from older people, like it, they say where the wind left, where the November moon left the wind, and this year it left it down southwest. It's not a good point for the November moon to leave the wind down southwest. Any other where the older people say, but southwest.
So this is something you learn from experience,
from
watching the weather, from listening to stories that were told to you growing up as well.
Yeah.
And that's part of it. And do people ask you about that?
They do, yeah. They always ask, like, you know, I'd say, well, this summer is not going to be great. And I'd say, why? And I just tell them about where the wind was left by the November moon, as the moon went out.
The geology of the Cliffs of Moher and how they were formed is a fascinating story in itself. A story that goes back 300 million years. The cliffs are comprised of layers which are rich in fossil formations but are quite weak. Dr. Eamon Doyle is a geologist with Clare County Council and the Burren and Cliffs of Moher UNESCO Global Geopark.
Well, when you look at the layers, yeah, as you say, there are thicker layers and narrower layers. There are layers that stick out from the cliffs. And those are the sandstone layers, the layers that the birds nest on, those ledges that stick out a little bit. These are relatively thin rocks, they're full of fractures. Actually, if you notice, they only stick out from the rest of the cliff by maybe 6 inches at most. That's because if they stick out more, they'll fall into the sea. They're not very strong. But the constant pounding of the waves at the base of that cliff are eroding away the base, and then pieces higher up will fall down. But apart from that, there is inherent weakness in the cliffs. So those are lines of weakness. In the limestone, they get dissolved out and we form those, the grikes. They extend right through the rocks in the Cliffs of Moher as well. So these are layers of weakness, lines of weakness in the rock. And because these fractures are vertical, when the rocks fall away from the cliffs, they fall away and leave a vertical face. And that's why the Cliffs of Moher are vertical. It's because of these fractures that are in it. And these fractures are lines of weakness. So as the waves are pounding in, they exploit those lines of weakness they will erode away bits and they will fall into the sea. Those fractures that are in the limestone that are in the cliffs of Moher, they're fascinating for another reason, that how do they get there? And they got there because when we were on this continent down near the equator, we were colliding with another continent. So these two continents were coming together, and as they did, the stresses built up in the rocks. The rocks were hard, and the stress, like anything, when you put stress on it, if you put enough stress on it, it'll break. And the stresses built up and the rocks fractured. And they fractured into millions of tiny, narrow fractures. They're very long, they're very high, I guess they're vertically, they're very deep. So these fractures release that stress. So all across the burn, you can see them very easily. You don't see them in other areas because they're covered with soil and whatever. But if you look at the cliffs more, those vertical lines here, you can almost line them up here. You can see the vertical edges of the cliffs. They line up with these vertical fractures in the limestone. But they are the result of a continental collision. There would have been massive earthquakes happening when this was happening. But this is a stress release. So if you push something, the stress will release that way and you get all these little fractures, and there's millions of them. So that's what gives the cliffs of Moher its vertical features, which is why it's so famous for it, but it's also what gives the burn the limestone pavement features that we're so familiar with as well. So it's a continental collision that happened, you know, 290 million years or so. The geology is so important to the surface of the landscape that people come to look and photograph.
Coming up after the break, we'll make the short journey down the road from the Cliffs of Moher to Moher Hill Open Farm.
Atlantic Tales on Clare FM, in association with Nolo Loughlin Insurance Services, for all your general insurance and life assurance needs. Call Noel 086 845 9912. Visit o'loughlinfinancial.ie.
Welcome back to the programme. Just a kilometre down the road from the Cliffs of Moher is Moher Hill Open Farm. The farm was created to teach and educate visitors about animals, both those traditional to Irish farms and those with a more exotic origin. The Canavan family started with an area of just 6 acres, which has since been expanded and developed into a 15-acre family farm and zoo. Martin Canavan always knew he wanted to work in tourism.
Well, we got the idea. I worked in tourism, actually, in the Cliffs of Moher when I was a young fella growing up and when I was in secondary school. And I had a very distinguished title when I was at the Cliffs of Moher. I was the assistant curator of O'Brien's Tower. And the curator was a man called Joe Vaughan. And you know, Joe is long dead now, but Joe was great. Joe was a great mentor for any young fella that had any interest in going into anything in tourism or meeting people. And, you know, we were country lads and we were shy, but he was a great mentor. And he was also a great ambassador for tourism in Liscannon and Lahinch. And he was one of the Vaughans at the Vaughans Hotels in Lahinch. I worked in Aircom then after that, and I always had the idea that I would like to do something in tourism. So we got the idea in 99, we had this piece of land here, and we got the idea to develop it, or to research the development of it. Thankfully, it went well, the development, and we worked hard at it, and we got opened on the 16th of June 2000. So we're 21 years open. My wife and my family, Shane, Lorraine and Alan, the three of them, they have worked very hard here to develop it and to run it. We sourced animals then all over the country and some from outside the country, and we got opened with our modest farm, and we developed our play areas then, and our indoor play areas, our ball pool, bouncing castle, sand areas and go-kart track indoors, because we needed to protect ourselves a bit from the weather here. We're in the shadow of the Cliffs of Moher and it can be very wild and very windy. But unfortunately, while we have the rest of the farm open now, we have to leave that closed right at the moment. But hopefully in the next few weeks we'll get to open all the facilities.
When you're starting off with a new business like that and you plan to bring in animals for the public to view and appreciate, how do you go about that? Because presumably you can't just bring in any animal.
No, you have to be very careful. And while, you know, they have to be, if you could get them, we were lucky now, we got some from farms who already had set up and who we became very friendly with since. Tourone in Loughrea and Glendearn at Athlone and Leahy's down in Cork. And we got some animals from those farms, but we also brought some animals from Cheshire Zoo in England. And those were, they were used to people, which is paramount in mind. They have to be used to people, and you can't have something that'll, you know, that'll snap or bite. But it still takes them a while. We're lucky now in that most of what we have now have been born on the farm and are produce of what we originally started with. Safety is everything, really, you know, and you have to judge the animal and you have to be careful where you get them.
What exactly then, Martin, do you have here?
Well, we have the most exotic, I suppose, that we have are the ostrich. And the ostrich is the biggest bird in the world and lays the biggest egg. And we have the emus, and all of which can be fed from the hand. And then we have the deer, red deer and sika deer, and llamas, alpacas, raccoons. You can feed the raccoons, but we're actually after building a new house for the raccoons while we were in the lockdown. And they have a beautiful place now. They have an outdoor area and an indoor area. But they're a bit nocturnal. It is in the night they do all their activities. And they tend to sleep a bit during the day. But they're a bit like the fox in this country. They're a pest, you know. They're in America. They're very big in Germany now again. And they destroy rubbish bins, overturn them. And they climb into attics of old sheds and things and sleep there for the winter. And they're a pest, really, in America. But we have them under captivity. There's no fear of visiting the neighbours' bins.
Caring for the wide variety of animals at Moher Hill Open Farm begins with the first feed of the day, but there are lots of other jobs to be done too.
The feeding is done in the morning, first thing, and I'm here about 7. And there's a lot between simple things that you wouldn't even think of, like picking up the papers and the papers that blow around the place. And the crows then, if they can get into the bins, they can shred these papers. And, you know, myself and the crows have a kind of a love-hate relationship all the time. We have progressed a bit now in that we have a zoo licence now for the last 4 years. You know, everything has to be, it's just like the farm at home, you know, the dairy farm or the beef farm. Everything has to be documented and everything has to be right, you know. And there's that care farm. I have a degree in agriculture and I do a lot of my own care farm, but we have a great vet, that team in the same of Underhill Burn vets, and they're great. John himself is brilliant around. And the more exotic they are, the more John would like to be dealing with them, because, you know, it's a challenge for him, you know, and he's great, John Underhill.
And of course, a stone's throw from the Cliffs of Moher, where you worked many years ago, on the Wild Atlantic Way as well. How important has that been to the business in recent years?
Oh, Pat, it's hard to even quantify it. It's everything, because, and the traffic on the road, you know, the traffic on the road going from Lahinch onto the Cliffs of Moher and onto Doolin, it is the Wild Atlantic Way, but the traffic, you know, has been everything to us down through the years, and we hope that traffic will continue. It's, you know, all the continental visitors, and they see the sign and they come in, they see the animals up the top of the farm from the main road, and Americans, and, you know, those are people passing the farm is everything to us.
And what about COVID then, Martin? Because during COVID you still had to mind the animals and feed the animals. That must have been pretty tough as well, but it had to be done.
Yes, Pat. The first lockdown, you know, it was a kind of a novelty for us after 20 years. And we did jobs around the farm. We created a new hygiene station down at the end of the line. And that was great. That worked a treat for us, because it saved people coming back into the coffee shop, having to go to use the toilet or wash their hands. And, you know, it was great, because we were able then to create a one-way system. And when we had an inspection about opening last year, they were very happy, but the helper were very happy with what we had created and the way we could do it in a one-way. So that took up most of the first lockdown. As I said, that was a kind of a novelty for us, and the weather was brilliant. But then the second lockdown, winter, financially draining, and it wasn't as nice. We were delighted to get open the 1st of May.
Of course, you weren't making money, but you were still spending money on maintaining and keeping the animals fed and minding the animals as well.
This is the problem, Pat. And you know, when you don't have people in the farm for the first time maybe in 20 years, you do tend to do jobs that you would normally be doing, and that adds to the cost, you know. And it's a chicken and egg situation. You haven't the people coming in for any cash flow, and you're spending. It's not good, really. It's hard to do.
Welcoming people back to the farm after being closed for so long because of COVID-19 was a great day for the Canavans.
It was brilliant. And, you know, for myself and for Dylan and the lads going, you know, it was great, because, you know, we didn't know, really. We didn't know how long we were going to be locked down. We were so naive at the start. we thought that the first night that was that Leo Varadkar came on television and said about this lockdown, we were so naive, we thought it was only going to be 2 or 3 weeks that we were going to be up and running again for Easter. And we just hadn't an idea. But it, when we got opened, it was like going to a new job, actually, again. And even to get the card machine up and running, get everything up and running and organised, and then we had to do the perspex around the counter and all the safety aspects of it. But it was great, but it was different coming back again. It was great to see the first people in the door, I tell you.
And long may it continue. Being in here at 7 o'clock every morning feeding the animals, this obviously is a labour of love as well, though.
Yeah, I like what I do, and I like meeting people, and, you know, it has been great. And, you know, our own lads, even though they have their own jobs off farm, they still do a lot of work here in the evenings, and we were even here yesterday evening late, and, you know, and they have done a lot of work with fencing and with all the different construction work. We do a lot of our own construction work, and it wouldn't be feasible otherwise, you know, to... It wouldn't be financially feasible if you couldn't do a lot of your own construction work.
The deer here is roaming around quite freely. This lad here is having an old rest. What's this?
This is an alpaca. And actually, this fella has a well-deserved rest, Pat, because he's 21 years old. He was one of the first animals that we got in the farm. And himself and the ostrich and one of the Falabella ponies up the top there, we'll see him in a minute. But he's just having a bit of a layout in the sunshine. He's an alpaca. They come from South America. And they're used for their wool and for their food quality in South America. And then we have the llamas, they're up further, but the llamas are more of a pack animal than what they're all part of the camel family.
We can hear the crows, the ones you have the love-hate relationship with, and a lot of them.
Yeah, they're like a small army. They follow the people, children in particular, drop a lot of food. And they're... Tis enthusiasm, really, to feed everything and to run from one animal to another, and they drop food, and we give a bag of food to every child coming in, a flake maize, and it's a safe food. If a child ate it, it's very safe. But the crows follow them, and they have a ready-made dinner, sure, ready-made meal all during the day. But I don't mind them eating that, but it's when they tear into the bins of me and go into the bins, it's when I shred the paper.
a small bit of a free attraction, you don't have to take care of them.
That's when the hate comes.
What else do you enjoy about this, especially 21 years later?
Sure, Pat, you know, it is great. I worked all my life, like, between Aircom and the Cliffs and when I was going to school. And it's great. It's great to be able to work for yourself. You know, even the view, I never fail to look around down along. You can see right down into the Skelligs. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Kerry Mountains, a clear day, Mount Callan across the way and all down along the coast. It's a lovely spot, but I never fail to admire it in the morning especially. Yeah, it's nice. 99.9% of the people are, you'd love to meet them, you know, they're lovely people, and people in holidays and from different counties and different countries even, and I enjoy all that. I enjoy the animals as well.
Tonight, dear friends, I'll sing a song. A toasting glass I'll raise to a place that means the world to me, on the wild Atlantic way. A land where blessed feet once tread, where kings and princes roamed, a place of beauty and renown. Clare, my heart, my home. So raise your voices, one and all, sing out, let it be known. The banners flying high tonight in Clare, my heart, my home.
Liscannor Bay and Moher's Cliffs greet white Atlantic foam, and Burren's beauty uncompared, majestic land of stone. The rolling hills of Tala, in Shiprone and Craganore,